I'm live now, so should be able to request being a guest.
Just
Hopefully
looking
this
for.
works.
I see
Hopefully
you there.
the dog doesn't be too loud.
I assume anything
Oh, I
up
wonder
in
if I can
here.
tag. I think I can tag friends. Let me see if I can tag you. I mean, I know we're not technically friends. There you are. Okay, I just tagged you, and I'm not sure if that means that you can be on the video or what.
Okay.
I don't see a request to add yet. Okay.
There was something that popped up
Okay.
and then disappeared.
We're adding our philosophy guest, philosophy professor guest, to talk about whataboutism today. So I've got him on the phone. We're waiting for the Facebook technology. Lori St. John. Good day to you. Or as Laurie, as we say in Australia, good eye. Good eye. Jared, what up? Thank you. It's actually I forgot to put Rogaine on, and so it this happens every time I don't put Rogaine on. Any luck on your end?
Not seeing anything here.
Because I'm able to. Let me see if I can invite you to watch. It doesn't. Man, this is really hard on an iPad. Okay, I'm going to invite you to watch. Did you see anything on your end?
Yeah, it says to watch and invite to watch. So I'm watching
Okay,
it now.
okay. Really?
Watching it now and it just can't
I don't
see.
have you any record of you. 'Cause when it says you're watching, I could bring you on camera, I think. I'm a total moron on this stuff. Oh, sorry. You know what? Okay. We're gonna figure it out. Any luck? I guess we should have tried this. Stay with us, peeps. All I see is a bunch of stupid masks I can put on. Doesn't even say that you're watching, Adam. Are you on the phone at the same time? Maybe get off the phone. Are you doing it on your phone? Maybe it was too much for the phone. Try. We're trying, guys. We're trying. Hopefully, Zuck doesn't win. Okay, cool. It just looks black to me. Adam, are you there? Adam, going once, going twice. Julie, Adam, Julie is asking, did you click on the green request to join button? I can't see Adam. I can't hear him. Adam, try it again. Okay. Says you're watching. Okay. Okay, good. Let's try it one more time.
Can you see me?
Okay, I can hear you.
I can hear
Yeah,
you.
I can see you.
All right, there we go.
Not today, Satan. Not today. Not today. We got a very special guest, Adam. Professor Adam teaches philosophy and religious studies, critical thinking at a major Cal State. And thanks for being here.
Hey.
We're going to talk about whataboutism.
Good to see you.
Good to see you too. I heard the term whataboutism when one of my friends, I was bringing up, I think, I can't remember exactly what I said, but the topic was the so-called insurrection of the 6th of January, the so-called riot, whatever you want to call it,
Right.
protest. And what happened last year, what we all saw last year, which was a bunch of riots and violence, that seemed to be excused by the left, and which bothered the rest of us, I think. So, this person said, "Nice whataboutism," and then I noticed other people mentioning it, the word whataboutism. So I brought you on to talk about whataboutism. And apparently we're not the only ones, because Bill Voegele of the Claremont Institute wrote a piece recently. And then one of my friends, Professor Wolf from Houston, he wrote in a comment in that Powerline blog had had a the title of something I wanted to write called "What About Whataboutism?" So they already took the title. Great. But my thought was that when we're having a talk about justice and fairness, that we oftentimes proceed by analogy. We argue from like cases. So that means we have to bring up other things to compare the situation to.
Sure.
And that's how it proceeds in law. You read a court case and they're constantly referencing other cases. And I'm trying to imagine, the what people saying that judge, that's whataboutism. Come on. Like in when you read the, for example, the Second Amendment cases from, the major ones, Heller and McDonald. The issues are, what about the United States versus Staples from 1994? What about United States versus Miller from the Great Depression?
Right.
So, National Firearms Act. So you have to proceed by comparing the issue at hand with these other issues that have already happened before. And I thought you had some really interesting insight on that. So, what did you think about that?
Yeah, no, I think you're right here, right? The arguing from analogous cases is a way of trying to get at an underlying principle, right? And I, like you, I've heard the phrase whataboutism probably over a year ago, maybe 2 years ago.
Oh,
It
wow.
was actually new to me in terms of the terminology, but not new to me in terms of the fallacy that underlies it. Right. So this is a variant of the Tucker fallacy, right? And so really what's attempting to do, right, as a fallacy, if we're going to just accept it as a kind of fallacy, is it's a deflection. An argument is made, and then the move rhetorically is by the other person is to say, well, what about this case over here?
Yeah.
And
maybe tell people what the tu quoque fallacy is. That's Latin for you two or something like that.
Yeah, so it's just a fallacy that attempts to discredit an opponent's position. Through the charging of a, in this case, a charge of hypocrisy, without directly refuting or disproving their argument. Right. So I think there's important components there, right? The one important component is the hypocrisy charge, but also the failure to refute the initial charge to begin with, right? So I think those are two at least related issues, but I think they're distinct. With the whole protest, and certainly there's numerous other spheres in which this whataboutism is charged against people. But as I was going to kind of set up here, so the argument comes, right? So here's the problem, right? It's event X is a Y. It's the Capitol protests were a riot. They were an insurrection and whatnot. And whether or not that's true is based on the definition of terms and whether or not there are relevant events within the context of those particular events that within the context of that event that are fit the definition, right? We'll just put that aside for the moment. So the charge is made, and then someone comes back and says, well, look, here's another case, right? What about the summer protests? What about this, right? So here you can see even naturally the language of what about just kind of issues forth. What about this, right? And so if that is done, and I think there is room for this this is a legitimate fallacy, right? This is not illegitimate. If someone is attempting to draw another case to deflect away from the underlying argument, right, then you have a fallacy. But suppose, though, and I think this is what's probably happening, is that many people are saying this. I accept your underlying argument, right? Now, what exactly the events at the Capitol really fall under definitionally, okay, so that we can talk about that. But many people are saying, yeah, the Capitol event, it wasn't right. Whatever it was, whatever kind of terminology you want to label it with, whatever it arises to in terms of being a either a riot or a protest or an insurrection, we can accept that. And so if I accept that argument and say, hey, the Capitol was bad, when I then go, what about this event, past summer or what have you, it doesn't matter what it is, what about this event? Now we're in different territory. Now we're talking about analogous cases, as you said, right? So if you charge this with scenario X, what about scenario Y? Y seems to be structurally identical to X. And so now we're in the grounds of which, once you've accepted that initial argument, now we're on the grounds of talking about hypocrisy. And I think that's probably what most people are really concerned about, that ultimately the media narratives surrounding these events are disingenuous or even hypocritical. So.
Yeah. Yeah, the charge of hypocrisy is relevant. I think it's only a fallacy if it's not relevant.
Right.
See, these are supposed to be fallacies of relevance, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like in a courtroom, it depends on what the purpose of the charge of hypocrisy is, because the charge of hypocrisy might be that it undermines the credibility of the person whose testimony I'm listening to.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's relevant, right?
Sure.
Just like in a court of law, if you try to impeach somebody's testimony, it might be that what they said is true, but the question is, should I believe it just on their authority?
Right.
Just on. And so the issue of authority is kind of well, it is relevant. It could be relevant, put it that way. And I think with the media is particularly vulnerable to that because the media, as we traditionally understand it, proceeds on the basis of authority. Journalism, classically understood, in the way we understand, well, at least the way I was trained in journalism, the old school way, not the social justice left-wing activist way that's relatively recent, but the old school way of journalism was that you have to develop a moral credibility, a credibility where people trust you, because oftentimes you might be the only source that they really interact with on a particular issue. They might not have the evidence that you have, so they're just trusting you. And so, but in terms of just the pure analysis of, oh, that sign, oh my gosh, I did that sign. In terms of the pure analysis of the analogy, figuring out whether two situations are analogous would require you to look at both of them, at least possibly, right?
And so this is
If there if there's disanalogies, then you have to you still have to look at them.
Well, yeah, and I think there are certain cases
Are you there?
where, can you hear me?
Okay.
I think we're back. I think where the whataboutism claim can be one of the charges is that whataboutism is a kind of deflection away from the central issue. And whataboutism itself, the charge
Yeah.
can also be a deflection, right? It's I don't want to look at the underlying analogous
Yeah.
cases, so I'm going to charge with whataboutism to
Yeah.
avoid having to look at those things, right? And so
That's right.
To compare,
Because you don't want the analogy to proceed. You don't want the
no,
comparison
so in this
to
way,
proceed for political
this
reasons.
is where I think I've even seen people that I think I respect pull the whataboutism card pretty rapidly without considering, I think, a lot of the dynamics that underlie it, right? That in some cases, as Beaujolais points out, these are kind of rhetorical political tools to stifle debate. They're not intended to explore the matter. Because at the end of the day, right, if we don't have a shared conception of justice from which to work from, then we're in trouble, right? We're in more trouble than you can know. So I think it's important that we get to the root of these cases and really compare like with like and define the relevant similarities and the relevant differences. Because then, if we don't have a shared conception, underlying conception, then we essentially get two teams that have their own conceptions of justice that work from their own basic principles, and you
Yeah,
have, you know, additional
that's not good.
the additional problems that work that follow on top of that. So.
Yeah.
So, and one thing to remember too, is when you get to the issue, just to
I'm
settle on
looking
it.
up insurrection. I'm looking up insurrection in the dictionary while you're talking.
Well, I was just pretty much going to go there, right? So, if you look at the protest, riot, insurrection, right? These are all three distinct terms. They certainly can be interrelated. The protest is a gathering essentially just expressing disapproval, right? There's nothing really even that interesting about the idea of a protest. But a protest can become a riot. There could be just riots, right? There could be something that's functionally a riot. Riot is a violent disturbance of the piece by a crowd, right? Other always also a group kind of dynamic here. So something could be a riot
yeah.
or a protest. They don't have to necessarily intertwine, but a protest can, riot could be a form of protest that's possible. So there's some intermixing here. When you get
sure.
to insurrection, though, you take basically protest and violence and then aim it at an authority or a government. That's when you get an insurrection.
Yep.
So
let me bring on camera Black's Law Dictionary.
And there's insurgent. I don't know if you can see that. One who participates in an insurrection. One who opposes the execution of law by force of arms. Who rises in revolt against the constituted authorities. Here's insurrection right here. A rebellion or rising of citizens or subjects in resistance to their government. It, you know, shall consist of any combined resistance to lawful authority of the state. What do I think of when I think of that? I think of burning a police car, which I saw countless times last year. I never heard it called an insurrection. I mean, did you hear that term last year?
I can't remember actually. It may have been labeled that by a few people. I don't think any of the major.
I never heard it.
Right. I don't think any of the journalists.
So when I started hearing it all of a sudden.
Yeah.
I see all these police cars on fire. They're lighting government buildings on fire. They're occupying government buildings. They're occupying government property.
Mm-hmm.
I never heard anything about an insurrection.
Right.
I barely heard the term riot.
Right. Right.
So I was a little bit shocked when I heard it on the January 6th one, because I didn't see any arms.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see force of arms. And you and I both know this is why the Biden administration is coming for people that they oppose, right? The politically oppose.
Mm-hmm.
Because peacefully and legally, that side is heavily armed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's apparently they think that's a threat to them.
Yeah.
But I thought, given how well armed that side is, if it was really an insurrection, it would have looked a lot different, I thought.
Yeah.
But then it did. To me, it looked like a mob that got rowdy and out of control with a few, maybe a couple dozen, trained insurgents or whatever. Who knows what side? Maybe different sides. But these definitions are very important to get,
mm-hmm.
and the application of these terms can serve political purposes, right?
Sure.
Rhetorically, that's kind of what your point is, right?
Sure, sure. Yeah, and I think one of those, all the protests in the Capitol incident is that there's also another fallacy at work here, right? And the fallacy at work is potentially a kind
okay.
of hasty generalization, right? So we take a few bad actors in a particular protest
yeah.
who then riot or then insurrect, and then that changes the dynamics. And so, look, media follows the car accident, right? They don't care about, you know, the weather. If a protest is kind of milquetoast and it's ostensibly like the weather, well, you follow the bad actors because that's where the action is. And so, and this can apply, right? And again, this gets into comparing like with like. You're going to compare
yeah.
the protests over the summer with the Capitol protest and whatnot. All right, so maybe there's a handful of bad actors in both of them that drove these particular incidents of violence or even potentially a rising to the level of insurrection. And so in that case, we have to remember a kind of the proportional representation of who's really acting. The Capitol thing seems weird to me because, number one, the ease of access, which the protesters got in there for, But then when people start to label it an insurrection, I find that difficult, because what I'm seeing is very cartoonish characters, right? Buffalo guy and the guy with the lectern smirking into the camera, the person on Pelosi's. I mean, are these really, I mean, these are some sorry insurrectionists. Like, these are some clown car level insurrectionists if they are. Not what I would think to rise to the level of a real genuine insurrection.
It just seemed like the application of that term was just politically convenient. I mean, given the absence of it last year, it was just a little strange. But I suppose,
Well, the other thing too is that the media is not incentivized, right? So you look at the structure of media. Media is not incentivized, at least when you get to the major networks, towards applying terms equally across the board. Maybe there would be some incentivization if the Biden administration turns out to be as boring as people predict or want it to be. You might find viewership dropping, in that in order to drive viewership, you might find
That's a good point.
They might actually bring up, they might actually start to ask tough questions and bring on and start to kind of do their job more consistently. But right now, the major news networks have decided that the incentivization is towards being in a good relationship with power. And so until that incentivization structure changes, right? Because if I'm CNN, I can start to ask hard questions of the administration, but I risk having a kind of pipeline or conduit to power. And so without that, without that, you know, I have to make a choice there as to what I want. So anyways.
Yeah.
Well,
there's another issue that's related to this. That is, when people have feigned outrage about a comparison. How dare you compare? And, you know, everybody does this. I mean, what I mean is, well, I don't do it, but my side does it quite a bit, where they'll say, I can't believe you compared. How dare you compare so-and-so to so-and-so? My thought is, it's never wrong to compare, because it's the comparison that allows you to see if they're not like each other. You have to do the comparison to see how unlike. So for example, someone got upset. One of my former Pepperdine students got upset that I did a meme where Biden was Mao Zedong. And they were publicly shaming people who voted for Trump. It was a historical picture, and Mao's face was, you know, switched for Biden. Well, my thought is that if Biden is unlike Mao, you only know that because you compare them. You have to do the comparison. It can't be that the comparison is wrong to do that, because otherwise you wouldn't know whether they're like or unlike. And you're just your assumption is they're not like each other, but you only know that because you compared them. So I never say that you shouldn't compare two things. And I rarely interrupt somebody if they want to compare something. If I have time, I'll listen to it.
Right.
Because chances are, the longer you talk, the more you're going to find disanalogies. You might find some key analogies too. And so I've noticed that there's a rhetoric, like what you're saying, there's a rhetorical move to interrupt a comparison before you're able to get the point out about whether they're like or not like each other.
I think with respect to the whole meme, like the meme back and forth, there is a kind of meme war, I think, that goes on. And I don't think...
Which we're winning, which we win.
So In terms of the meme war, it seems to me that there's almost a kind of a tacit admission on both sides is that we're not really interested in discussion necessarily. We're interested in scoring points. If that's not true, then I think that's been lost in a kind of team meme combat. So then where people just it's dodgeball, right? Right. So sometimes you've ever played dodgeball and you've been hit and there's that one guy on the other side that always hits you. Right. And you just want to get him back. And so it feels like the meme war is a little bit like that. It's like a game of dodgeball. You know, it's tinged with revenge and just wanting to win. And so there's no actual invitation to discussion. The second thing I would say is that with respect to memes, when people are offended, and I tell my critical thinking classes, all my classes, this, that the being offended is basically the lowest form of criticism, right?
Yeah.
It's just a kind of guttural, in some cases, socialized response to a phenomenon. There's not anything terribly interesting about being offended. So in that regard, when something offends someone, right? So we're right to want to just, you know, compare cases here, but we have to also ask ourselves, I think, what are we interested in?
Right.
Do we really want to discuss the issue? Do we really want to go over the details and talk about it and reason together about it? Or do we just want to play meme war, which is, look, people have fun with the meme war. But I don't know, is it going anywhere? Is it actually, you know, I'm sure there'll be some research or media studies on the efficacy of memes in terms of altering or shaping political discourse and voting. Maybe that research even exists now.
But, yeah.
You know, I don't right. know on the face of it if it looks like it's really a productive way to interact. But my broader concern, though, is that people don't want to. People are not interested in actually discussing these things. They've picked a team. They have judged the other side, you know, evil, and anything they say can and will be used against them in the court of the meme war or the cult or broader culture, you know, employing certain elements of doxing and all this other stuff. So I think things have really just incredibly broken down. And so I think the question for a lot of people is, do we want to keep going in this direction? Right. Is it doing anything for us? Is it doing anything to settle some disputes, right? Or disagreements. And so part of that, though, has to be, you know, has to come from a sense of, I think, openness, right? And willing to tap into the other side. Some of my background is in political science, right? Yours is obviously too. We went two different directions in terms of the political, our studies in political science. But for my investigations, one of my emphasis was media politics. And if you look at it, right, the data.
Yours was more empirical, right?
Yeah, I think. Well, yeah. There's.
Is that what you would say?
I would say it's more empirical. You certainly have the legal side.
That's certainly the way I went.
And political theory, I think, was probably both of us at the same time. So we do have some overlap. Yeah. But when it comes to media politics, right? You know, just off the top of my head, number one, media objectivity is a myth, right? It's a kind of historical myth that media at some point was objective in the past.
It tried to be.
Well, yeah, it was less inflammatory, perhaps less partisan,
I don't think it ever was,
no.
It tried to be.
Right. So let's not pretend that we can somehow go to an objective media past, you know, to
sure.
bring that into the present and whatnot.
No.
But the second thing is concerns social media interaction, right? So social media interaction,
yes.
The social media environments, right? You take the collection of all the websites, social media platforms, as well as political websites and whatnot. And there were scholars who were able to just basically unearth the connections between them, like who signed up for what, who recommended what other sites and whatnot. And so they basically charted this on a kind of scatter plot. And what you've got is that the right and the left, they're two basically non-overlapping spheres, right? So that whatever's being discussed on the right is
Not good.
it's there
Not
there's
good.
no right. The right doesn't know what the left
Not
is doing.
good.
The left doesn't know what the right is doing. Really,
Not
what we have is
good.
caricatures of one another. We don't have any kind of
Well,
we're not
the
interested in.
big tech censorship only exacerbates
That's
that
exactly true.
because it's just cleaning out one side.
Yep.
That's not good.
Yep. It's actually drawing a more definitive line and wall between the
Yeah,
two
it's
spheres.
making it worse.
And so, in terms of polarization, what big tech is doing, regardless, look, for some of us, we're deeply affected by the big tech censorship because we're on the
That's on
right.
one side. That's on one side of the political
Right.
spectrum, by the way,
So
big tech. Yeah.
some of us, right, that are watching this might be not affected because you're not on the right, and that's fine. But the effect of big tech censorship and deplatforming is further polarization, right? It enhances polarization. It does not do anything to diminish it. So if you view
Yeah.
polarization as a problem, then supporting big tech, regardless, like forget the whole free speech angle, right? If you want to have a conversation about polarization being a problem, then you've got to stop the censorship, right? Because that's just exacerbating this polarization. For people who care, right, that should matter. Other people, they don't care about it because, again, winning is all that's important, right? Not finding a principled way forward.
Yeah, that's a lot of good stuff there. I want to point out before people forget that you compared memeing with dodgeball, so there was a comparison there, right? And that's great that you were able to feel free to just start comparing. I mean, we do this all the time. We need to compare things. We need to have the freedom to do that. When I teach logic, I go through argument by analogy, I always say that argument by analogy is like a good analogy is like a good car. All analogies break down, but a good car, and all cars break down, but a good car gets you where you want to go before the car breaks down, and that's the same thing with an analogy. So we need to be free to use them. They're very helpful. And then the second thing I wanted to point out was you mentioned something about being offended as a conversation stopper, basically. I think I'm not sure if you didn't say it exactly that way, but I just wanted to let you know that I was very deeply offended when you said that.
Okay. Well, you need to move past it
And
then.
I haven't heard anything that you've said after that. It just,
Yeah.
I think you have to have like a sense of humor with this
You
stuff, because
do.
otherwise you're going to go
I
crazy.
think you
You're
do.
just going to go
I
crazy.
it yeah, I think you do have to not take it too seriously. And not take, not take
Yeah.
ourselves too seriously. That's the other thing as well.
Well, you and I have a kind of an occupational, it's an occupational hazard maybe, but it's not really a hazard. It's we enjoy the conversation. We're not afraid of it. We're not afraid to have the discussion.
Right.
So I'll walk right into the fray. And in fact, I think that's good. But a lot of folks are not trained well. I think that's really the issue. They're not trained well. They're not trained to handle disagreement because maybe they don't know their own side and they're afraid, or they don't know the other side very well and they don't understand how somebody could have the other side and be kind of like them in many ways. So,
Yeah. No, it can be
I
daunting.
don't know what else to do besides,
I mean, you have spent a lot of time in training, and I've spent a lot of time in the woodshed as well. So, we're not worried by this, but a lot of people on the Republican side, I know for the Democrat side for sure, because most of my students are Democrats, but a lot of people on the Republican side, on my side, they're not prepared to have these discussions and to listen carefully and give the other side as much of the benefit of the doubt as they can, and which I do. I try to. If some, like for example, when people were comparing Trump to Hitler, I never said don't compare. How dare you compare? I was like, fine, you compare them. Make sure you do the whole comparison though. Don't stop in the middle. Make sure you trot out all of the things about Hitler that would be different. And you'll see a lot of things that are different. For example, Hitler was not removed from power after 4 years. Trump's term was going to end whether he wanted it to or not. That's just in the Constitution, and I think he always knew that. I interpreted everything he did after November as campaigning for the next time. I think he knew he wasn't going to eke this out. He was just fighting. He wasn't going to go down without a fight. And that's all ammunition for future for future election. He can enter the fray saying, hey, this thing was taken from me before. I never gave up. I'm not going to give up on you again. And maybe hopefully he learns if he does that. Hopefully he doesn't start a new party. Hopefully he learns that he needs to be nice to people a little bit more. And maybe without Twitter it'll be easier for him to do that. I don't know, but yeah, I mean, just fine. You wanted to make the comparison, fine. But and I don't even mind if you call it an insurrection on the 6th, fine. It meets the definition in certain respects, I suppose. But to keep repeating it over and over again, like, just it's almost like, did you get that? Half the country, did you? Here's the, for the 200th time, we're gonna say the word. That it just gets a little bit much, and it feels like you're not really interested in moving the country in a positive direction. A lot of people's businesses were just destroyed last year. I mean, I'm not even talking about the virus, but the virus. People are not in a mood right now, and the government is in no position to take itself too seriously, because all of the tax money that it lost last year, not only the stimulus and the direct stimulus and the unemployment supplement, but also the loss of income tax. The because you have to make income for it to be taxed. Unemployment is not subject to state income tax. The government is going to take a major hit. Sales tax, sales tax. Grocery stores don't pay. You don't pay sales tax on food. That doesn't count. Payroll tax. That's what funds the government.
No, the
Still got the government. The government didn't go out of business. It still has a budget.
Well, I think too,
So irrational.
there's just to kind of maybe revisit a couple things before, I think there's a
That's good.
lot of Republicans that need to move from a fear-based politics, to a knowledge-based politics. And that transition is going to require work.
What do you
It's
mean?
to well, I think in many cases people
What do you mean? That wasn't the real one. That's the Christian one.
So I think that it's to move out of a position of fear, of fearing the other side, to knowing, right? To knowing I think what it is that you believe, know the arguments for why you believe it. And look, this goes doubly for the other side too. The left, in a way, is politics of fear of the right. You know, and I know plenty of professors when they get in the classroom who they don't know any other arguments other than their own. They only know the left, right? The left's structure of argument and essentially talking points, and they'll never venture into criticisms on the right. Now, to be fair, there are a bunch of professors who do. They'll take up both sides, as I think is right and proper for a professor to do. I do know there's a host of them that they won't entertain the arguments. And so what actually happens, I'll just give you kind of an example, is that there'll be people in their classroom who are, say, let's say Trump supporters, and those students who are Trump supporters feel alienated from the classroom. Now, as part of pedagogy, and one of the things that people are concerned about is inclusivity. How do you be inclusive if you're alienating a strong minority of your own students? And part of that is the professor, number one, has a kind of fear of them, but also doesn't know the arguments, right? Doesn't know the rationale for why they are Trump supporters. They're not willing to entertain it, and they're just dismissive of these students. And so I can't tell you how many students have come to me thanking me, some who've gone on graduate school, who thank me for having an objective approach to being in the classroom, that I'm not afraid of certain arguments, right? And they're going to take that into their practice or their teaching or their graduate school experience. And so I'm very thankful for that, to at least have tried to model it in some small way.
Yeah, that's good.
So,
you know, the way I've done that, my classroom in different ways, I've tried a lot of different things. I've done the quote unquote objective person before. I've done where my students, I drive them nuts because they can't tell where I'm coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've done ones where I just let it all hang out,
sure,
and I just tell them where I'm coming from. And
and both approaches can be effective, right? So
yeah,
I do know.
Depends on the crowd you have.
Right, so I had a professor.
Depends on the topic, too.
That is true. And so it kind of takes a judgment call in the classroom in the moment. But I did have a professor of political science who is a political theorist, brilliant guy. But if he saw the classroom kind of like kind of moving one direction, he would take up cause for the opposite argument.
Yeah.
I
think that's what I do the most.
Yeah.
That's the one I do the most.
So sometimes it would be an argument, you know, maybe he was talking about, you know, political participation or something like that, or you know,
it
doesn't matter what the subject was, but there are times that he would just say, look, I'm sympathetic to this argument over here. I may not agree with it, but I'm sympathetic. Let's drive that argument and see what happens. And so I think there's not a wrong way necessarily to do it. I think the important part is that the students come out of it with an understanding of the arguments.
Yes.
Yes. On both sides. So, or all sides. Sometimes there's more than two, but.
Yeah, well, and I the way I look at it is, I don't see myself as a good defender of the left.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't recall being in a position where I felt like that point of view was getting short shrift in my classroom.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like, I have to really think about this, but it seems like most of the time it was the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
So that actually, this is ironic. This is something that's deeply ironic in my experience, that when I was being most objective, that's when they could tell I was a Republican. That is very ironic.
That's interesting.
Because
because I was balanced. And the thought was, well, why would you be so balanced if you didn't have some kind of agenda?
Mm-hmm.
And so that made me realize what's going on in the other classrooms.
Right.
That I, you know, and right. Of course you know what's going on in the other classrooms. All I have to do is walk around campus and see the paraphernalia, you know, laying around, the histrionic "don't deport my student" posters everywhere, and Kavanaugh, nope, when Kavanaugh was, you know, just it's crazy stuff.
Right.
One specific example, I was teaching abortion. I was teaching applied ethics downtown Los Angeles about 10 years ago. And I had working professionals. They worked for the city of Los Angeles. It was an adult class for Los Angeles Community College District. And so we got to abortion, and that was in the official catalog description for the course was that topic.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, capital punishment and euthanasia, which I never understood why that was controversial. There's old people in Asia. Why wouldn't there be youth in Asia?
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, but abortion, and I had a complaint from this lady because I spent a half hour on the pro-life position. And I pointed out to her that I also spent a half hour on the pro-choice position. I actually spent longer on the pro-choice position than I did on the pro-life position.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that I had equal time was for her just obvious that I must have had some agenda as a pro-life person.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, why would, because other, you know, I mean, you would just do the pro-choice position and you would, the pro-life position, oh, you know, it'd be some straw man, you know, it would be some caricature that would be ridiculous.
Sure.
And, you know, 5 minutes maybe or something like that.
Yeah. Know. Yeah.
Maybe you assign a piece, you know, but it's not really a good piece.
It's unfortunate.
Yeah. It's not taken seriously.
Yeah. Yeah. What was I going to say? I just had remembered something I forgot. With respect to the classroom, you know, discussion, you know, maybe we'll circle back around to our topic here. But, you know, I've asked my students, I say, well, you know, if an institution was over 90% Republican, you know, what would you say about that institution? Right.
Also.
Right. And so most of them will come out and say, oh, that institution's probably biased.
What do they say?
Yeah. They'll probably say that institution's biased.
Yeah.
I said, well, okay.
Yeah, that's good. That's
so
good.
So what if an institution is 90-something percent
They fell right into your trap.
Right. And so realizing, right, and this is not too, long after we're talking about logic and logical consistency. And so they said, well, that would probably be biased too. I'm like, okay, well, the university environment is basically 90-something percent Democrats. You know, does that bother you?
Do they not know this, or is this like a
this.
Factual thing they're finding? They don't know it?
They don't know this. No.
Whoa.
No. I think, I mean, one of the best things to read, I think, on some of this stuff, I mean, I really like Jonathan Haidt's work on some of the dynamics of the university system.
He's really good.
Yeah, he's exceptional. I know there's plenty of criticisms of his work, but I think he goes a long way to as a good starting point for, you know, identifying and discussing some of these problems. So I would just highly recommend
The Righteous Mind.
Yeah, Righteous Mind is outstanding. And I actually use some of his content in the classroom.
And you don't even have to get the book. You could just go to the YouTube. It's on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
He's done it probably a dozen times where he summarized that book.
Yeah.
In conversation with people.
Yeah.
And his last name is Haidt, H-A-I-D-T. D-T, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
So. Well, this is a interesting discussion about whataboutism.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately.
My concern.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, my concern has been that, in general, that conversation is shut down. That's why I hate censorship. I hate it.
Mm-hmm.
The more information, the better. And I'd rather not have the fake news tags on these things. I don't think they're that helpful because half the time they're on there and you're like, Instagram tagged me. I'm the Republican professor on Instagram. They tagged one of my memes that I shared. It was two different, one had Donald Trump in it. The other one did not have anybody in particular in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it tagged it as a false comparison of Trump with Biden. And I was like, well, what makes you think it's a, I didn't even think of Biden when I shared it.
Right.
So how could it be a, and first of all, what's a false comparison? I know what a false statement is.
Yeah.
That's when the statement, it doesn't match reality, but what's a false comparison?
Yeah.
I don't even understand what that is.
Yeah.
When you're comparing something, that's an activity. It's not false.
Yeah. When it comes to
it's not true or false.
Yeah. When it comes to the censorship stuff, I think, you know, you got to realize there's probably no one behind the wheel, right? It's an algorithm that somebody's developed to pick up on key phrases like, oh, it's artificial intelligence. It's not third grade level artificial intelligence. It's just picking out certain key phrases and words in proximity to one another, and then judging that to be, you know, a particular political post of a certain type, et cetera, because again, there couldn't be enough people, right, to work. You'd have to double Facebook payroll overnight to have enough people to inspect each one at a time. But, you know, so the social media companies, I don't know, they're in a tough spot. I mean, I think the lens of Congress is on them, and they're forced to do something. I think in some cases the algorithms they're trotting out and using, they're just unsophisticated. They're you know, maybe they need some better engineers or something like that. But so it's again, but the central point is, that kind of censorship, you know, if it was, and you know, again, on pains of consistency, if we're going to be consistent, if the media organizations were all owned by people on the right and they're censoring people on the left, that would be, I would say that'd be wrong too, right? Regardless of which direction it goes, I'm just in principle against censorship, right?
Yeah, me too.
And so again, at the end of the day, if polarization is a problem, then forget, don't even have to look at the free speech argument. If you want a less polarized environment, simply engaging in censorship in this way, and in a kind of one-sided way, is enhancing polarization. It is not diminishing it. It's not to say that necessarily everything else that we're doing right now can diminish it. I don't know what can diminish polarization, if at all. It's something I'd have to do a little bit more thinking about, but media censorship is not helping. So
definitely not. I definitely think that the universities are hyper polarized. It's not surprising to me that people who come out are polarized
mm-hmm.
too as well. Okay, so let me get to the comments here. We're going to summarize before we get off, just so people remember. Julie, let's see here. Okay. Chris is saying, still happening in Portland. Jeez, I did not know. Define hypocrisy. Oh, definite hypocrisy. I thought it said define hypocrisy. Amy, okay, thank you, Amy. Julie, wouldn't not my president count under that definition? I'm trying to remember what definition that was.
Was that a form of protest?
Maybe she was talking.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I you know, I don't
seems
know.
Like the, that would be
the not my president thing bugs me because this is where we get in terms of conflating all our categories, right? Like people say something like, hey, are you a fan of the president? I'm like, no, I'm not a fan of the president. Oh, did you like the other guy? I'm not a fan of them either. Fan label
yes.
doesn't apply to any political person that no. I would vote for, because fan, right. short for fanatic, is for sports, right? It's like, are you a fan? I know it's shorthand for do you like this person or whatever, but this our categories are crashing together here, right? And that's one of the other problems, not keeping things separate. And so I'm not a fan. Hey,
Separate but
oh, you're not a
equal.
fan of Trump? No, I'm not a fan of Trump. I'm not. Like, fanship doesn't enter into the discussion for me.
I never liked his page. I never followed him on Twitter. I didn't have to. Whatever I needed to see, I knew I would see from the hyper-polarized media.
So it's the fanship or
I think he made me
hatred.
laugh. He made me laugh. I
Yeah.
didn't understand the hatred. I mean, I understand he was not he, his strongest suit was he was not a politician. And that's also his weakest part. This is what a lot of people who don't that do love Trump, they don't understand this. You liked him because he's not a politician, but that's also why he had a hard time getting reelected. That's why people become politicians, because politicians care what people think about them. And it turns out that that's sometimes very helpful in getting elected. It's like such a basic thing, but yeah, I appreciate what you said about being a fan.
So and then when you know
Yeah,
get
that
to
was
the
good.
my president, not my president. President isn't personal, right? So when people say not my president, I think it's kind of sore loserdom in a way. It's a little bit kind of petulant and whatnot. It's like, not my president. Like, oh, fine, but that doesn't change anything. He's the president, or if it were to be she's the president. And that's just
That's
objectively
what
the
I
case. So.
that's what I pointed out, which I never say my president. I don't say
No.
I had never said that he was my president. And I know a lot of people on Republican side said that. I love my president. I
Yeah.
never say that. He's the president of the United States. I'm not the United States. He's not a president of me. I'm not the government. He doesn't order me around.
Yeah.
And he barely ordered the government around, which is part of the problem I think that people don't understand, is that that there's been an erosion of the authority of the presidency over the administrative state. That's precisely one of the issues that we liked about him, is that he wanted to have control or more control over the administrative state. But yeah, he's the president of the United States. I mean, just like the Supreme Court, it's not like my Supreme, it's the Supreme Court of the United States. I don't think of the Speaker of the House as my speaker. It's the Speaker of the House. Anyway, okay. So, Julie, I hope that we satisfactorily. Okay, we got one from Eric Greenberg, who's a professor, colleague of mine at Loyola Marymount. Okay, yes, I agree with that, Eric. Thank you. Bottom line is that these clowns do exist and we need to distance ourselves from them. If we call ourselves conservatives, we need to stop letting nut jobs call themselves conservative too. I really don't call myself a conservative. I call myself a Republican. A quick, just very quickly, I'll ask people, did conservatives end slavery? Republicans did. Republicans did. So that's not a conversation stopper. It's an invitation for further conversation. Another one would be abortion. That's an obvious one. How do you define conservative? People always say it's to conserve the status quo or whatever, but a lot of the things that we complain about, we don't want the status quo. I don't want the status quo on abortion. I don't want the status quo on capital punishment. We don't execute enough. If it's going to be a deterrent, you have to actually do it. If speeding tickets wouldn't be a deterrent either, if chances are you wouldn't have to pay the ticket.
I think,
It's the same
well,
thing.
conservative, I think, is one of those terms that has kind of experienced a kind of cultural or ideological drift that it
Well,
probably.
it's just a relative
It,
term.
well,
It's
yeah,
a
so
relative term. It's
people,
like saying left.
you might as
It's
well
like
go
saying
back
left
to,
of.
yeah, you might as well go back to Russell Kirk and just read Russell Kirk on conservatism and just start there, kind of start over, and then compare that to what you understand conservatism to be. You might find some things that are not what you expected. So, but
I think when I took liberalism and conservatism with Charles Kessler at CMC, we started with Burke, I believe. We started even further back, the French Revolution.
I think we're...
Savvy, good.
No, go ahead.
I was going to read. Savvy says, "I love that it's a sin not to compare." Okay, good. Getting some freedom there. We should want to reason together, Amy says. Yep, exactly. Like that's going on what you were saying about polarization. Julie says, definition of insurrection. Okay, I think we got that. I think I got through all the comments. So let's, you want to go ahead and just wrap up and summarize
Sure. Well, I'll just say
where we
that,
went?
yeah, so that whataboutism, right, is a logical fallacy, right? It's an informal logical fallacy that's meant to deflect from, right, the central argument that's being made. But it all depends, as we, might say, as devil's in the details, right? It depends on what it is we're trying to do. If we have accepted the underlying argument and we're pointing to some other issue, an analogous case, that is not a fallacy. That's not whataboutism, right? We're trying to get at an underlying principle. And in many cases, whataboutism, to continue to say that that's a fallacy at that point is, I think, an attempt to just shut down the discussion, or to protect previous judgments of analogous cases that went a different direction, right? Look, no one wants to own up to hypocrisy. No one wants to admit they're a hypocrite. I've never seen anyone do in public that they were, admit they were a hypocrite. And so there are powerful egocentric forces here, driving to protect one's reputation, and to protect, because, and this is one of the things with the internet. The internet is almost forever here, right? Your judgments,
Well,
whatever positions you
unless you're
take
the
up,
president.
yeah, well. Yeah, unless your positions are your positions are always out there, and so if you go back on a previously held position, right, you're opening yourself to the charge of hypocrisy. But there's no incentive there to acknowledge that, right? The incentive is always to deflect the blame, to dismiss, to change the subject, or ignore completely. And Jonathan Haidt, actually, he'll spell out why this is. That for whatever reason, we have this enormous capacity to rationalize when we have made errors, and in some cases, very public errors. So the incentivization there is not to, it's not towards repentance. It's not towards admitting fault or ownership or anything.
Right.
So that's pretty much, I think, where I'd leave it.
Yeah, and I'll circle back on that. I think that whataboutism is the way it's oftentimes used is itself a distraction from having a conversation where we can get clearer about what we mean by certain terms or the fairness of the application of those terms for political purposes. And I'm against that. I'm against shutting down conversation. That's why I let people say what they want to say on my page. You know, I for the most part, there's been a few instances where I've had to shut people down.
Sure.
But I've discovered that in fact, I will talk differently on purpose just to get people to think differently about what we're saying. Slow down, define our terms. Let's make sure that we really understand this term that we're throwing out there. That's why I mentioned that thing about conservative is that people use these terms, they just talk the certain way, they say certain things, and oftentimes the way they use the term doesn't really make sense to me.
Right.
At least it doesn't to me. You know, conservative, if conservative means conserving the status quo, I don't appreciate being a felon if I conceal carry on a college campus,
Right.
given school shootings.
Right.
I mean, it's very dangerous. I mean, we all agree on that, right? It's dangerous. So why would you criminalize self-defense
Right.
if I'm trained?
That's the status quo. I'm not for the status quo,
Sure.
and that's not what people mean when they mean
Yeah.
liberal, but I would say that I'm more liberal on that, I guess.
Right.
So yeah, defining terms and
Classic
having
liberal, yeah.
conversation. And I don't you think that's the way forward in terms of this problem of polarization? That's what else is it going to
Well,
be?
yeah, exactly,
What
right?
else is
It's
it going to
almost
be?
by process of elimination you could even go like and just arrive at this conclusion and just say, look, nothing else is working, right? There's nothing. Are we going to continue down these various roads, the paths that have led us here, in hoping that things are going to change, they're going to be different, or are we going to do an about face and try to get back to some semblance of interacting with people that we don't agree with, and also in many cases don't understand. And
Yes.
so that's, I think, important that we move back in that direction, because
Well,
again, yeah, I don't see any of this, and I'll just say this: Jonathan Haidt has expressed, he's deeply skeptical of things not getting worse. And this was many years ago he laid this out, because people have, again, made a comparison between our time and the 1960s, for example, right? And the kind of tumult of that particular time period. And that, well, we got through that, so we're gonna get through this too, right? And Jonathan Haidt is looking at it is, okay, are the cases similar? Is there anything present now that was absent then that somehow derails the conclusion that we're going to get through this as well? And he says, yeah, there's social media is a big part of it, right? Social media, polarization. I think there was one other thing that he might have mentioned, but those are big components. In the 1960s, there was a block of policies that we generally were in agreement on, right? So, domestic and international relations, not much variation there. Not much in terms of domestic policy. There wasn't a lot of variation there. So there was more agreement than disagreement in terms of the totality of all the issues. And we don't have that now. We've got disagreement almost in every area, in addition to social media, which is exacerbating the disagreement and polarization. So Jonathan Haidt's conclusion here is that, this is not the 1960s. We are in a worse predicament than the 1960s. And so it's going to take an act of just stopping and turning around and trying to get back to some central sense of, I don't know, interaction with people that disagree with you. As I guess we've already said that, so.
Yeah, I would add to that, grade inflation is different. There wasn't as much grade inflation in the 1960s, so that if you wanted a good grade in history, you actually had to read.
Sure.
You had to think. You had to actually learn how to think and reason,
Sure.
make an argument. And you don't have that anymore. I've seen the students, they just expect high grades for doing very little work, and they don't read. They don't read. The only way I could get people to bridge this polarization in the classroom was to force them to read by threat of a bad grade. That's gone. For the most part, that's
Yeah.
gone. That's
It
the way
has,
of the
sadly,
dodo.
yes. Yeah. I
So
mean, there are some.
education has made it worse.
Yeah. That'll be a subject for another time, perhaps.
That's a different topic.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for sharing all your insights on this stuff, and I really enjoyed talking with you. So, do you want to have any last words or last thought?
I'm good. It was a pleasure. And yeah, thanks for bringing me in. And we'll talk soon.
Okay.
All right, man.
See you.
Bye.
Bye.